All right, good morning.
Morning.
It's been a while since I've been back. I've been preaching at a church, filling in for my past RA for the past month or so. I let the elders know here that I was going to be absent, and it's been fruitful, my time there. I'll get a Sunday next Sunday as well there. My buddy was just—he was doing some missionary training, so he's planning to go to Japan. That's where his ministry is going to be, and so he's partnering with Mustard Seed Church Planting Organization. And he was set to graduate last spring and then just ship off to Japan, but obviously this whole COVID thing messed all that up, and so he's staying in the States. And so he's training here now, and so he asked me to go out and fill in for him, and that's what I did. But I'm glad to be back with you guys this morning. I want to start this message this morning talking about the concept of fear, right? There's so many things to be fearful of today. We talk about it, it seems like, every morning when we wake up, especially coming to church. It just we come to each other and we update each other about everything that's happening in our lives and all the fear surrounding the circumstances that are just so prevalent today. And we're going to be looking at a guy. Here's a little warning. I know Chris probably talked about Moses with you guys. I'm going to come back to Moses. I hope you guys don't mind that. We're going to look at Moses's the pretty much the start of his ministry, not even whenever he was leading the Israelites out of Egypt. So we're going to look at the decision that he made in order to follow God, follow through with God's request for him to do that. But before we get to that, let me just remind you that on this whole concept of fear, Franklin D. Roosevelt, in his inauguration speech, you remember what he said? It's one of the most coined phrases in the world today. He says, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," right? And I think I have the rest of the quote on my phone. I don't have time to get that out. But what he says after that is fear basically, it paralyzes much-needed efforts to turn retreat into advance, right? I think that one, it really hit to me whenever I was creating this message, because when we talk about fear and everything that's going on in the world today that just keeps us grounded and crippled and feared, it causes us to either move backwards or to stay put in place. It never allows us to move forward when we let our fear cripple us. And that's what Franklin D. Roosevelt was saying whenever he was being inaugurated, and he had this big mountain to climb coming out of the Great Depression. The economy was crashed, and people are asking, how's Franklin D. Roosevelt going to help us do this, right? And so he comes at it with this speech where he basically just says that when we let fear rule our lives, it turns advance into retreat. Right, so like I said, we're going to be looking at a guy named Moses. So if you want to turn in your Bibles to Exodus chapter 3, we're going to be there. And I'm going to kind of set up the background for us right here and what brought us to this place. So in Exodus, we can pretty much sum up the entire book by saying it's the deliverance of God's people out of oppression, out of slavery, out of Egypt. I'm going to give you guys some more time to turn to Exodus. I apologize. Something I'm learning in my preaching class this semester is I need to take more time letting people get into the scripture. I preached a sermon this last week, and everybody was like, "We couldn't even turn to the page before you started going." So I apologize. Exodus chapter 3. And so, like I said, the book of Exodus, it's basically the book of God delivering his people out of slavery, out of oppression, and out of Egypt. And he's going to use Moses to do that. Chris preached a message to you guys on what that journey would have looked like. And I want to preach to you guys this morning, what brought him to that decision? What encouraged him, motivated him to say yes to God in this instance? Because Moses was a pretty questionable guy in the beginning part of this book, and we're going to see that as we make our way through. So chapter 1, we see that that the Israelites are being fruitful. They're becoming numerous as the stars, as the covenant of Abraham would allude to back in Genesis, God comes to Abraham and says, your descendants will be as numerous as the stars. And that began with Isaac, and now it's continuing through the Israelites, and they've moved into the land of Egypt now because Joseph, he was moved into slavery, right? And now he becomes second in command over all of Egypt. And so there's a famine now, and Egypt's the most prosperous land. I know this is a lot of historical background. I'm just trying to catch us all up to date here. So Joseph would have been the last pharaoh or the last person with any sort of influence from God at this time in Egypt. And now Joseph has passed. The pharaoh that was in charge that went to Joseph for everything, him being second in command, he is now gone, and a new pharaoh has come to power. And this new pharaoh, believe it or not, as we're talking about this concept of fear, he allows fear to creep into his mind, into his leadership, and how he's going to lead the country. And he sees the Israelites becoming fruitful and multiplying. And then out of this fear, he begins to oppress the people, right? He says, I don't think I like how numerous the Israelites are becoming. Pretty soon there'll be too many Israelites that we won't even be able to control them, and then they'll strike up war against us, and then they will take over, right? And so out of this fear, he begins to oppress the Israelites. He begins to work them harshly and long days. There was hardly ever a time where they had day off. They'd go to work, and then when they worked a long 18-hour shift, they would go home, rest, and then come back the next morning and do it all over again. And they're being treated harshly by these Egyptians. And so part of the hope that Pharaoh had in this was, okay, well, if I just don't give them time to lay down and rest, they will stop making babies. They will stop producing offspring, right? And so he's trying to dwindle down the number of Israelites that are becoming fruitful in this nation, right? And this pretty much doesn't work. And so Pharaoh then has to resort to throwing babies into the Nile, right? And so we see this horrendous thing happening in this nation because of the fear of one leader, right? And so we introduce ourselves to Moses, right? Moses was the little cute baby who, in children's school, he would have floated in the basket. His mother saw something in Moses and said, you know what, I can't just simply get rid of this guy, right? And so she floats him down the river, and Pharaoh's daughter comes and takes him into her care. And so Moses would be raised in an Egyptian household, but he never forgot where he came from, right? And so we'll find that out here in chapter 2, verse 11. I'm going to read for us right here. It says, one day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew? And the man said, who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and thought, what I did must have become known. And then it says, when Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled to Midian. Basically, he got out of Dodge. He said, I'm going to go live in a foreign land because what I've done has become known. Right? So we see another instance here where Moses, a different character, comes into the scene, and he gets struck with fear because of something he did, right? And so Moses, he recognized where he came from. He recognized that he was a part of the body of Israel. And even though he was raised in this Egyptian household, he still understood that he was a part of this body, and he saw this body being oppressed, and he took matters into his own hands. I don't know if it's probably been a long time, but I've probably used this phrase way too much to sound redundant now, but when we take matters into our own hands, it never works out for us, right? And this is what Moses does right here. Moses is like, I'm going to solve an injustice based off of what I see. I see a Egyptian beating down on an Israelite. I'm going to take matters into my own hands, and I'm going to get rid of the oppressor, right? So he does that. He gets rid of the oppressor. Yay, Moses is the hero, right? No, it says in the next couple verses that he comes to solve another conflict, this time amongst two Hebrew men, two Israelites, who would have been his own flesh and blood, essentially. They would have been his brothers, right? And even they, whenever he comes in and tries to solve the conflict, he's gonna try to do this in a way that, you know, not as violently as he handled the Egyptian, because these are his people, right? And so, but the Hebrews, they don't recognize that. They see him in this position. They know he's probably been raised in an Egyptian household, and so they don't know where he sides. Does he side with the people of Israel, or does he side with the Egyptians? Or is he simply just playing a middle ground, making his own judgments as he sees fit? And so these guys, they actually rebuke him, and they say, are you going to do to us the same thing that you did to the Egyptian? And so Moses is probably just struck by what they said, because he's probably thinking to himself, what are you talking about? I got rid of your oppressor. The person that was beating you yesterday, what's wrong with me helping you guys out? Like, I thought we were the body that was told to be fruitful and to make descendants, right? He's identifying himself with them, but these guys have just shut him out because he took matters into his own hands, right? And so he flees. He goes to the land of Midian, and a lot of commentators say that he's going to stay in this land of Midian for 40 years. The fear that he had because of Pharaoh coming out to kill him because of the consequence of his sin of killing another Egyptian, it kept him in a foreign land for 40 years. And we don't get anything else. That's a lot of time. And when we read the Bible, we get big chunks of events happening at one time or another. And then later on, you know, everything seems to be fleshed out in like one fluent story, right? One cohesive time. But this verse right here, despite the abruptness to it, Moses is going to spend 40 years pretty much doing nothing on behalf of God, right? And so I think I've said this before as well. Our sin can lead us away from God for numbers at a time, for long periods of time, if we can't think to get back on track with God. Now, God's not going to wait around for Moses to figure that out for himself. God's going to come to Moses in the form of a burning bush, right? So chapter 3, you get this burning bush illustration. God calls out to Moses from the burning bush, and he says, Moses, Moses, I have something to tell you, pretty much. And Moses says, here I am, Lord, here I am. And then God comes to him and says, hey, I have heard the cries of Israel, and I want to use you as the tool to deliver those people, right? This is an amazing, humbling moment. And then Moses is probably thinking to himself, talking to this bush, just laughing now. He's like, oh, really? You're going to send me back to the people that 40 years ago had just kicked me out? To a land where Pharaoh wants to kill me because of a crime that I committed? You're going to use me to go back to these people and minister to? And God says, yes, that's exactly what I'm going to do. And so Moses begins to wrestle with God. He begins to question. He's like, Lord, first off, why am I going to be the first person to do this? Why me? Surely I can't be the one to do this. And so we're going to look now at chapter 4. We're going to see kind of three requests that Moses makes on behalf of God to pretty much just give himself an out of this whole experience. He wants no part of it. He says, Lord, I've been here for 40 years. Life is good. I got married to a nice little shepherd girl. I'm living life well. And he says, just let me continue to live life well. And so he's going to have three excuses pretty much for God. So the first excuse is going to be chapter 4, verse 1. So follow with me. Exodus chapter 4, verse 1. This is right after God had just called him to go to the people of Israel. He's choosing Moses, and Moses answers, what if they do not believe me or listen to me and say, the Lord did not appear to you? All right, then the Lord said, what is that in your hand? He goes out and he gives Moses these three signs, right? So Moses' first request is, you know, how can I be sure that these guys are going to believe me? They didn't believe me 40 years ago whenever I said I was for them, and when I wanted to defeat the oppressors, right? They didn't believe me then. How are they going to believe me now? And God says, fair point. See that staff in your hand? He said, yeah. And he says, throw it on the ground. He throws it on the ground. It turns into a snake, all right? One of the miracles that he's going to perform in front of the Israelite people. And he says, pick it back up, and it turns back into a staff. So there's one sign. And then he says, now I want you to put your hand into your cloak, right? And so he does that. He pulls it back out, and his hand is covered in leprosy. Just nasty, whatever leprosy looks like. I'm sure it's gross. And then he tells him, put it back in and then pull it back out, and it's completely restored. He said, this is the second sign I want you to show the people of Israel. And then he says, and if that doesn't work, I want you to take some water from the Nile and pour it on the ground, and instantly it'll turn to blood. Right? So these are three signs that Moses gives just out of this first request, just to please the Israelite people, to show the Israelites that God is with Moses. Right? So this is honestly one of the better excuses that Moses is going to give. We're going to move on to the second excuse that Moses has now. This is going to be in verse 10 of chapter 4. Moses said to the Lord, pardon your servant, Lord. I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. right? So now he's putting the blame now on himself. He's saying, okay, you got me there. You know, I got three signs I can come to the people with. Maybe they'll be receptive of the message through those. But Lord, how can I be sure that I'm going to fulfill on your promise? Like, I'm slow to speak. I suck at talking. This is a land that I've been kicked out of for 40 years. I don't even know if I know the language, right? And so he's given himself this sort of excuse, right? And then the Lord says, you know what? That's not a good enough excuse for me. He says, don't you know that I made mouths and I could speak through you just as easily as, you know, you could speak all the languages of the world, pretty much is what he's saying. And so he says, you know, you're not going to give me that excuse because I made your mouth. I'm going to speak through you, and I'm going to make sure that you fulfill, you go through on this, right? So this is Moses' second request to just shut this whole idea down so that he can go back and live in the land of Midian for years on end and not do anything for the Lord. And then he makes a third request, and this third request is something we need to hold on to because it's probably the most desperate act that Moses could have brought to God in this act. And this is in verse 13. Moses said, pardon your servant, Lord, please send somebody else. Finally, he just gives up. He has no more excuses to give. And so his last request is, Lord, please send somebody else. And when the Lord calls somebody, he doesn't go looking for somebody else. This is what we're going to see. Like the whole book of Exodus could have stopped right here in chapter 4 if we knew that Moses made the decision that he's not going to make. If he made the wrong decision, right? We talk about trials and temptations, the series that I'm preaching through. We're looking at characters all over the Bible, and we're seeing how they responded to trials and temptations in their life. And Moses right here is asked by God to go deliver a people and to basically put aside any differences that he would have otherwise made in this land against his people. He has to put all of that aside and just say yes to God right here. And his last request is, Lord, please send somebody else. Now the Lord, he's gonna compromise with them. It's funny how God finds a way to help us out in our time of need, even when we feel like we don't need, even when we're not worthy of some sort of middle ground with God. He comes to us, and he tries to make the best out of the situation, and he wants us, to respond as obediently to him as he can. And so he's going to help Moses out right here. He's going to say, I'm not going to give you the out, Moses, but I will send your brother Aaron, and he will go with you. And he's going to, you know, you're both going to feed off of each other, and you're both going to be my spokesperson. You're going to go to this people. You're going to do what I said, and I'm going to be with you through it all. Right, and so now Moses has a choice to make. He came to God with three requests to shut this entire thing down. Now he's got no excuse. He's got no excuse to come to God with anymore. God has told him, this is what you're going to do. What's the decision you're going to make? And Moses says, reluctantly, he says, yes, I will do it. And so we get the entire rest of the book of Exodus to see how this plays out, right? Like I said, this book could have stopped here if Moses made the wrong decision. And then what would the book of Exodus be? It would be the failure, essentially, of God delivering his chosen people, right? But when Moses stepped up to the plate, did what God was calling him to do, when he said yes, we get the rest of the story, and we get to see how God pulls through on his promises, and then how he uses Moses to do that. And we see the deliverance of Israel, and we get to see God's love and faithfulness shown through that. Right, so as we think about this now, in our lives, in contemporary lives, let me ask this question, like, what are some things now, it's going to sound like a dumb question to ask, but what are some things that we're dealing with now in this world today that's causing you to wrestle with this fear? Right, we got the presidential debate coming up, and then COVID started at the beginning of the year, and places were shutting down. We didn't know what was going to happen. Everything's up in the air right now. And so what's the most scary thing for us all right now? It can be a number of things. It can be the pandemic itself. It can be whether or not, you know, God's going to lead this country the way that we would like it to be led. But I ask this question and I preach this message just to reinforce this point that when we do things our own way, and we sit in fear, just like in Franklin D. Roosevelt's quote, when we allow fear to creep into our lives, it paralyzes our needed efforts of advance into retreat, right? We can only go backwards when we're stuck in fear. And that's what Moses is illustrating for us right here. He doesn't want to move forward. He's just lived in the land for in a foreign land for 40 years. He's done nothing up to this point. The Bible doesn't say a lick about what he does in Midian other than marries a woman and works as a shepherd for a man. And then God comes to him and he continues the story. And so that just goes to show that the Bible illustrates stories of faithfulness. It doesn't show stories of stagnancy and it doesn't, nothing ever gets accomplished in the Bible because of fear, right? And so that's something that we all wrestle with. And I pray that as we all wrestle with this season of time that we're in, that we would look for ways to respond faithfully to God, whatever that may look like. It may be that we put aside, you know, our fears of going outside and just reaching people for the sake of the gospel because of the sake of a pandemic, right? What if we put that aside and we just simply say yes to God? And then it may also be the fact that, you know, a Bible college student is drowning in homework in a semester, and he's looking for an out to not do the homework and to not do any of the work. But at the end of the day, he's got to respond and say, all right, God, I'm here. I got a lot in front of me. Just be with me in this. I know that's my prayer for right now, so there's that. Whatever way we can respond faithfully in this time, it's such a weird time to be in for everybody involved. And we have to find our own way to respond faithfully to God. God's going to present us with opportunities like that, and we have to respond obediently. Real quick, I want to point us to the book of Hebrews. I want to end this with this final illustration. I don't know if I read Hebrews chapter 12 to you guys, but I think this really hits home on this concept of faithfulness and fear and what we're supposed to do in this life and how we're supposed to respond faithfully. So Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1, this is what the writer of Hebrews says. He says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. I'm going to read that verse for you guys again because I know there were pages still turning, and I apologize for that. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1, it says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. I think about this verse a lot. It's something I've memorized in Bible college by now. And when we look at life and we treat it like a race, we begin to see all the ways that God's calling us to be faithful. And so, you guys know I ran cross country, right? Maybe? Okay, so my first year of Bible college, I decided that in an effort to make friends and to use my athleticism as a way to do that, I was going to run cross country for the very first time in my life. Now, cross country is a dumb sport. I don't recommend ever running for fun or competitively. It hurts, it's toilsome, and it's just not fun. Not fun at all, right? You take more pain than you do getting enjoyment. And if you were a runner like me, you never won, so why do it? Right? So I ran cross country my freshman year of high school. And I remember my coach was amazing. He said, he'd always joke and he'd say, we're going to turn this tennis boy into a runner. Right? And so all throughout that season, he was all about making sure that I was in a comfortable spot to make this transition from running on concrete courts to running on dirt tracks for 5 miles at a time. And so I love my coach to death, and I appreciate everything that he's done for me. And these are basically the three things I took away from my journey through cross country. The first thing is this, that the race is not a sprint. It's a marathon. That's what he told me the first time I ever approached the starting line. You know, I just wanted to take off and run because I knew I had to keep up with all the people, and they were all faster than me at the time. But my coach came to me, and he said, listen, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. Treat it like a marathon. Pace yourself. Find an easygoing pace. Push yourself to that pace, and then just keep going, right? And so that's the first thing that I learned. The second thing, which is just as equally important, he told me to run with the pack. Now, when I say run with the pack, I ran with a pack all the time at practice. We had like an A pack, B pack, C pack, good runners, mediocre runners, bad runners. I was right here in the B pack. I was mediocre. which is, that said a lot. And so I ran with this B-pack, right? And even during, even on race day, when I thought he was just going to let us all loose like dogs just to take off and run towards the finish line, he said, no, I want you to stay in that pack. He said, if you leave that pack, you're going to run 10 times over at practice. And I was just thinking to myself, why? We train to run, and we train to race, and we train to win. Why, how are we going to win if we stick together? Like, if I'd rather somebody get ahead, you know, if I'm holding them back, by all means, I'll let go of the leash, and they can go. They can go seek the glory. They can go reach the finish line before me. That's fine. This is a race, right? We're all in it to win it. And he says, no, I want you to run with the pack. Because when you run with the pack, when everybody's mindset is oriented around this pack mentality, everybody stays together and everybody pushes themselves at an equal pace. And that equal pace, it's not a slow pace. Everybody runs with the fastest runner, which is the amazing thing about that illustration, about that fact that my coach told me when I just simply wanted to run as fast as I could, right? He said, when you run with a pack, you run stronger and you push each other even more to finish the race. And then the third thing that I learned is this. Obviously, you push to the very end. The race isn't over until you cross the finish line, and 5 miles is a long time for me. And so when I took all three of these things together, and especially now, looking at the place where I'm at now, where I get the opportunity to preach and do ministry and preach about faith, I love this race metaphor because it perfectly illustrates what our life looks like and all the things that we need to do. We need to treat life like a marathon, not a sprint. We can't rush through the highs and then walk through the lows of life. That's not what God's calling us to. That's going to leave us with, you know, great feeling of accomplishment, and then in our lowest points, we're going to be at the lowest rates of depression, right? And so when we run a steady pace, we can be content no matter what season of life that we're in, as long as God is with us in that, as long as we keep God with us in it. And then the second thing, we run as a pack. We meet together on a Sunday morning every Sunday. We're all a church body, and we work together as one, and we glorify God together. Church can't be done outside of a community. It just can't. Just like a race can't be run without a pack. And then lastly, we push to the very end. We don't know what that end's going to be. The end may be the end of our life. The end may be Jesus' return. But nonetheless, the end is coming. The finish line is coming. And we just got to continue to run this race. Let me pray. Lord, I thank you for the opportunity to preach to Mansfield this morning. Lord, I just ask that you'd lift up all the prayers on the hearts that are on the hearts of people this morning, whether they were said or unsaid. This is such a toilsome time and a hard time for us to deal with, Lord, and we can't possibly do it without you. And so, Lord, I ask that we would come to you, and we would lean into you and see what you want us to do in the midst of this time, Lord. I pray that we would not become stagnant in this time, and that we would just simply wait for it to be over. Lord, use us now. Stir in our hearts a means of pursuing you and finding something to be faithful for, Lord, because we know you're calling us to something. And whatever that may be, Lord, I just ask that we would respond to it faithfully like Moses did. It's in your name we pray. Amen.